When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The 21st century is going to be one long, continuous journey to transform the global energy system from black to green energy. And that's why we committed ourselves to fundamentally transform our company.
Hello, this is Owen Bennett-Jones. Welcome to Make or Break, where I speak to remarkable people who reached a moment where they just had to make up their mind. With guests spanning from across the business world, we'll unpack those critical moments and explore how these CEOs and entrepreneurs managed uncertainty. My guest today is Jakob Boss, the Senior Vice President of Ørsted, a Danish multinational power company that produces the bulk of Denmark's energy. Today, Ørsted is the largest developer of offshore wind power, accounting for almost 30% of the world's capacity. In fact, nearly all of the energy that Ørsted produces comes from renewable sources, and it's been described as the most sustainable energy company in the world. But that wasn't always the case. The company used to be known as DONG, which stood for Danish Oil and Natural Gas. Heavily invested in coal and other fossil fuels, DONG was responsible for almost a third of Denmark's CO2 emissions. In the mid-2000s, as public awareness of the climate crisis grew, DONG found itself besieged by anti-coal protests. And in a stark contrast to much of the fossil fuel industry, the leaders at DONG found themselves increasingly in agreement with the protesters. The key moment came in 2009 when Jakob Boss and the then CEO Anders Eldrup announced that the company would be switching from black to green.
We believe in a world that runs entirely on green energy, and we basically believe that this is the way the world is going, so we better get started early on.
As they set out ambitious targets to transform the company's reliance on fossil fuels, Boss and his senior colleagues faced considerable pushback from within the organization. People thought they were making a colossal mistake. But they persevered and managed to pull off one of the most extraordinary and profitable transformations of a company in the modern age. So, the question is, how did they do it? Jakob Boss, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Let's go back to 2005. DONG was making money, right, out of oil and gas. It was going pretty well.
It was indeed. Our core business was in fossil fuels and more specifically in oil and gas. We had significant offshore operations in the Danish, in the Norwegian and the British North Sea. Our core focus was in fossil fuels. Then in 2006, DONG acquired five other major energy companies in Denmark to become the sort of undisputed largest Danish energy company. And the companies we acquired were also in fossil fuels. So we acquired a very significant Denmark's largest power production based on coal. So that was sort of the starting point.
Can you just give us an impression of the scale of the operation we're talking about here? How many people were you employing?
Well, I'd say we were around 6,000 people at that time. You know, energy companies are typically not very sort of people intensive. They're very capital intensive. So you have a lot of producing assets. You have a lot of capital invested. But it actually doesn't take that many people to run these companies. But it was by far the largest Danish energy company, having around one-fifth of all Danes as its customers, and by far the largest power and heat producer in Denmark, with, as I said, also activities around Northern Europe.
Okay, and so to look at it another way, to measure it another way, are you able to tell me off the top of your head, In 2006, when you're into oil, gas, coal, how much capital had you as a company invested in those fuels?
Well, what I can tell you is that in 2006, when we made those acquisitions, we acquired other companies just at the sum of 40 billion Danish kroner.
40 billion kroner in dollars, that's roughly?
That's roughly $8 billion. So we were out spending significant capital to build an even stronger fossil fuel-based energy company.
Oh yeah, so it's real money. Eight billion is a big investment. And so then in 2006, you're going full speed ahead with coal. I mean, you were in oil and gas, and then you've got these coal companies. So tell us a bit about that. How much were you investing? What kind of things were you trying to do? How much money did you hope to make out of those coal investments?
Well, we had established this Danish market leader in energy, and our ambition was clearly to expand into Europe based on those core competencies in oil and gas exploration and production, in coal-fired power plants, gas trading, those types of business activities. That was the clear objective. This company was born out of the liberalization of the European energy markets, where all across Europe, energy markets were being liberalized, and that led to a significant consolidation. Some of the largest European energy companies were formed as a consequence of that liberalization. And our merger and consolidation was sort of the Danish equivalent of that European consolidation. So we were building a company set out to compete with the other major European energy companies like E.ON, like RWE, like EDF, and so forth.
When was the first time someone in the company said, you know what, maybe we should be looking at getting out of fossil fuels?
Well, in 2006, we actually wrote the first sustainability report for the newly merged company. And I was at that time responsible for our sustainability efforts. So in that report, which came out in the beginning of 2007, it was actually the first time ever that the company or any of the companies that were part of the merger put in writing that climate change was an issue and that we ought to do something about it. That was sort of the very first official recognition of the challenge of climate change.
And just to put that into context, this is 2006, which I think is the same year that Al Gore came out with his An Inconvenient Truth. So, you know, these ideas were becoming popularized, and the IPCC, the international body that sort of does all the calculations and reaches a scientific consensus on all this, that was, you know, underway, I think, or just about underway anyway. So there was people talking about it, and you were quite quick onto it.
Yes. So it's completely right. 2006 was the year where Al Gore came out with An Inconvenient Truth. It was also the year where Lord Stern came out with his report saying basically that it's cheaper for the world to address and do something about the challenge of climate change than if we don't do something about it. That was sort of the first major economic analysis of the whole issue of climate change. And then in 2007, the IPCC came out with its assessment report saying that it's more than 90% likely that climate change is man-made. So there were a number of important publications coming out. And that, of course, led us to start reflecting, is it really sustainable, both for the environment and the climate in general, but also for our company and our business model, to be so heavily embedded in fossil fuels and having our entire business model evolve around those fuels, when we start to see how big a problem fossil fuels is for the world's climate. And those reflections sort of started taking speed from 2006, 2007, and into 2008.
Yeah, but the thing is, this is what I find quite striking, is that most oil and gas and coal companies at that time would have, you know, been aware of these issues, and they would have written a report probably saying, yeah, this is maybe changing. Let's invest a bit in solar. Let's invest a bit in wind. Let's put some adverts out saying we're going green, and not actually do much to change the fundamentals of the business. I mean, that would be the normal reaction.
Yes, I think that is a very precise description of what many companies were doing. I mean, everybody were sort of experimenting a bit with renewable energy on the side, having teams in place to look into those technologies, build an asset here and there. And I think that was sort of the general norm in the energy industry. But the core business, the vast majority of activities was in fossil fuels. And the all the investment programs, all the capital was deployed into fossil fuels. And the realization we had in 2008 was that long-term, the energy system would have to change to build a more sustainable energy system that would not basically destroy our planet. And then I think what we did, contrary to many others, was actually to take the full implication of that. Having done that analysis, we said that means that we need to embark on this transformation long term if we are to have a future and be at the forefront of developing the energy system, then we have to fundamentally change. And that's what we did in 2008. We went public with our analysis, basically laying out all the arguments and the insights that we had gained from reading all these different reports and talking to different stakeholders and so forth, and saying the 21st century is going to be one long continuous journey to transform the global energy system from black to green energy. And we want to be at the forefront of that. And that's why we committed ourselves to fundamentally transform our company. And then in 2009, we made it a bit more specific by saying that by 2040, we want to have fundamentally transformed from being 85% black energy and 15% green today. We said at that time that in 2040, we want to reverse that. So we want to be 85% green and 15% black by 2040. And that was an incredibly strong vision coming out already in 2009, making it that concrete at that time.
Yeah, so just to be clear, in 2009, you're setting this amazing target to completely transform your business, mostly into renewables, by 2040. And in the event, you beat that target, I mean, by a long way, right?
Yeah, I mean, we arrived at 90% green energy in 2020. So we made it sort of 20 years ahead of time.
It is an incredible achievement, but I'm still wondering what made you different? Because, again, most companies are not acting on this information with the urgency that you did. So what are the factors that you think helped you to get this done, get into this position?
Well, I think there were a couple of things that played to our advantage here. First of all, Denmark is a country which does not have a lot of natural resources. We have always been historically in a very fragile situation when it comes to our energy supply. Going back to the 1970s, Denmark was 99% dependent on oil from the Middle East. And then in the 1970s, the oil prices quadrupled in a short period of time, leaving our small open economy very fragile and exposed to these major oil price increases. And at that time, the Danish society came together in a Herculean effort to say, we don't want that dependence. We want to get out of that energy dependence from the Middle East. And that led to a number of things, including to develop the Danish energy resources in the North Sea, transforming our power plants from oil to coal, developing the district heating system, taking a number of energy efficiency measures, and last but not least, starting to develop renewable energy also. We were starting to see this coming into the same situation once again, that the world would be shifting and we would end up in another vulnerable position if we sort of stuck to a fossil fuel business. So that was sort of one thing. The other thing was our CEO at the time. He was a former permanent secretary in the Ministry of Finance and had spent his entire lifetime in the government, and so he had seen firsthand the experiences from the oil crisis in the 70s and how much that left the country in a very vulnerable position, but also being very used to making these large analyses of what is going on in society and also taking the appropriate measures and decisions. So I think that was another thing that he could sort of see the strategic ramifications of the changing energy landscape, and knowing that if we did not adjust our company in time, we would be left behind.
So tell me about the investments you'd made, a bit about the numbers, because you were invested in oil, coal, and gas. You know, that's not cheap business. So I presume that when you're making this switch, you were writing off some significant investments.
Well, not to begin with, because if you sort of look at the announcement we made, we said that by 2040, we wanted to transform the company. And that was sort of, for all practical purposes, the technical lifetime of these assets. So the first commitment we made was actually to say that within the technical lifetime of the assets, we would be shifting the portfolio from black to green. So every time we take a black asset out of production because it reached technical end of life, we would not renew it. We would invest green instead. That was sort of the fundamental math of that portfolio shift that we announced in 2009. We were actually developing a very large coal-fired power plant in Germany, 1,600 megawatts. And at that time, we saw that, okay, that will sort of still fit in with our plan, even if we build it, because the numbers will still stack up, so to say. But what we could see, especially during 2009, was actually that this coal-fired power plant development project was getting into more and more challenging circumstances. We'd started developing it a couple of years earlier, and there was a big demand in that part of Germany to have such a coal-fired power plant. They needed to build new capacity. Our company was a world leader in building efficient coal-fired power plants, so we could extract the most energy out of the coal through our advanced combustion processes and so forth. But then all the things we've talked about regarding climate change, of course, also sort of found its way into the debate about this this coal-fired power plant development. And gradually we started to see how the framework conditions that we had originally built into the case started to deteriorate and so forth. The challenge was that we'd already spent 1 billion Danish kroner on developing the project. We hadn't taken the final investment decision, but we had spent a lot of money in this development of the power plant. There was increasing opposition, and the CEO had to make a decision: do we continue with this, well knowing that we'd already spent so much money developing it, or do we not?
So what did he decide?
Well, the analysis we made at the time was, I remember a conversation we had where he said, well, it would cost 20 billion Danish to invest in that power plant. He said, would you rather spend 20 billion on that power plant knowing that it will be standing there for the next 40, 50 years? It will have an increasingly difficult life with all the debate we're seeing around climate change and CO2, et cetera, et cetera. Or would you rather spend that 20 billion on two offshore wind farms, which we also had the option to build? What would you rather do? They would have an easy life for the rest of their lifetime. They will be sort of in the mainstream of what the public increasingly wants, and will be on the right trajectory. And of course, if you put it into that perspective, it's very clear that you shouldn't invest in the coal-fired power plant, even if you've spent a billion. We have the benefit in the energy industry of having to live with our decisions, and because they have such a long time horizon. We spent probably quite a lot of time thinking about how will this look over the lifetime of the asset. And that was clearly, when you take a 40, 50 year perspective, then it became very clear to us, this does not make sense. And that's why he had to go to the board of directors in December 2009 with the recommendation that we scrap the coal-fired project, which he did, and thereafter committed to never developing or building any coal-fired power plants again.
If you're enjoying listening to our podcast and feel inspired by some of the leaders you're hearing make tough decisions in make-or-break situations, you may want to equip yourself with the skills and capabilities to make your own difficult decisions. If so, the Open University's micro-credential, Management of Uncertainty, Leadership, Decisions and Actions is designed for you. Visit openuniversity.co.uk/management to find out more. Ørsted's gamble has no doubt paid off, but this overhaul was not as easy as it seems. Just as Dong began spending huge sums of money on renewable power, it was hit by the financial crisis. And then, in 2012, Dong's gas business took another major hit as prices in the US plummeted. All this at a time when the company's debt was soaring in order to pay for the wind rollout. But instead of turning back, they doubled down. To save precious capital, they jettisoned 8 businesses, including all gas, hydro, and waste-fired power plants. After receiving a much-needed cash injection from Goldman Sachs, by 2014, Dong was saved, and in 2016, wind power earnings began to soar as the technology became ever cheaper. And then, in 2017, Dong sold their North Sea oil and gas business and changed the name to Ørsted, to reflect its near complete transformation from fossil fuels to renewable energy. In just 10 years since it began the move from black to green, the company increased its market value by several 100%, taking it to nearly $30 billion and making it the most successful green energy company in Europe today. Did you, as an advocate of this change within the company, have to persuade colleagues that you were right and they were wrong?
Yes, absolutely. And the challenge here is, of course, that we're dealing with the future. So we are dealing with something which is not 100% predictable, where I can sort of take out a spreadsheet and say, this is how it's going to be. I can only sort of make my strategic analysis and saying, these are the trends we're seeing in the market. These are the structural trends. This is what it will most likely lead to. There is nothing from what we see in looking ahead that will make these plants more attractive from an operating perspective than what they are today. But sort of moving to that sort of level of analysis, which is not sort of quantifiable with on two decimal places, but is more based on reading the structural trends in the market, that can be difficult for some people in a way, because they're used to sort of looking at some very precise forecasts and making their decisions based on that.
Now, I mean, I won't ask you your age, but you look a young man. I mean, you're a young man now, and this was 2009, so, you know, you were younger still. I wonder whether you were dealing with older colleagues and whether you had self-doubt that you thought, you know, maybe they're right and maybe I'm overdoing this.
Yeah, you're right. I was even younger back then, and yes, it was a little bit daunting to engaging these dialogues with people who had spent their entire lifetime in this industry, and of course knew much more about how to operate a coal-fired power plant, how to build one, and had been deeply into the economics of these assets. I had spent a lot of time talking to my colleagues and understanding sort of where they were coming from and understanding what the economics were, so that I believed I knew as much about what was driving the business case and the profitability around these assets. And then adding some of the competencies and that I brought with me to analyze sort of the broader picture and sometimes take that leap of faith, you could say, from going from sort of numbers with a very high amount of certainty and into another type of factual analysis where you have less certainty on the numbers, but you have a pretty high certainty around which direction things are developing. And I think that's probably one of the things I added was this combining the traditional type of analysis and understanding of the business cases with sort of what are the trends we are seeing.
So you took a risk, but it paid off.
Well, I mean, you could say I took a risk because I couldn't be sure that it would turn out this way, but it turned out to be a very successful strategy, right? So it turned out that our transformation is one of the most, if not the most significant energy transformation among large energy companies in the world. The company's market value increased by a factor of 10 since from 2014 and on until today. So we've had some proofs afterwards that it turned out to be the exact right strategy and that we actually were significantly ahead of our competitors in making this transformation.
In this series, we've spoken to some guests who made big decisions, and it seems some of them say they just did it on instinct. Others were following trends and making forecasts. And it seems to me a bit that you're in both camps, instinct and numbers. Is that fair?
Yeah, but I think instinct, you shouldn't underestimate that. I mean, when people say they take decisions on instinct, they probably often have a lot of experience from a field. They know sort of what's moving and shaking. They've talked to people who've looked more into to what's happening in the future. They've been around for years. And then to me, that's also a type of fact. I mean, if you come in from the street and take a decision about something you don't know anything about, you'd probably not call it instinct. I mean, instinct to me is also when you actually know what's going on, but maybe you haven't sort of done a 20-page report with tons of calculations and stuff. You just have a lot of indications that this is the right thing to do.
If you were advising, you know, a young strategist in the energy sector, what advice would you give them as to how to manage their decision-making processes?
Well, I'd say that at first you sort of need to get the direction right. You need to understand fundamentally what direction things are moving in, and that comes from looking at data, comes from looking at reports, it comes from looking at multiple different domains, it comes from understanding and speaking to other people about sort of what's going on. And you need to form that view. And it's not enough sort of to just stick with what you hope or think or would like. You need to sort of triangulate between a number of different data points, and then once you sort of have the direction right, then you need to think about, okay, what is then the implication of this? If this is the long term direction, how do we as fast as possible prepare ourselves for that future, which we believe is gonna come, because I think that's also a mistake that many do. They actually do know what the direction is. They do know what the change is. They're just not taking the full implication of it, or postponing it and say, yeah, that will happen in some times, and we'll sort of adjust slowly. That has always puzzled me. I mean, if you know where it's going, why don't you spend all your efforts trying to prepare for that future which you have seen?
Yeah, well, in this series, we've been discussing as a theme managing uncertainty, and you really did that very, very successfully. So it's a very striking example of what we're trying to understand. So Jakob Bos, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by Radio Wolfgang for Audi. It was presented by me, Owen Bennett-Jones, and it featured Jakob Bos. It was produced by John-Joe Devlin and Eli Block, with sound design by Paloma Kaufman. The executive producer was Ellie DiMartino. And that brings us to an end of the first series of Make or Break. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'd like to say a big thank you to all of our guests and to the Open University for their support. Please remember to subscribe, leave us a review, and share the series with anyone who you think might find it interesting.